Welcome to A Conversation With, an interview podcast series where we invite leaders, designers, and prominent figures in the board game space to sit at our table and take part in a conversation. Today, Cole Worley takes a seat, a proclaimed designer and scholar fascinated with mechanical systems and depicting history through gaming. We'll discuss his role in Leader Games and the focus within his company, Whirligig Games. Pull out a chair, pour yourself a drink, and join the exchange.
I am your host, Jesse Anderson, and I suppose I should start with something along the lines of hello, hello, just because that's what I'm comfortable with. Today, we are having a conversation with Cole Worley from Leader Games and Whirligig Games. Sir, nice to chat with
you
finally.
Good to talk to you again, man.
And for any of you who are listening that don't know who this is the designer of Root, of Oath, of Pax Premier, of John Company. I mean, a few titles that my fan base is moderately, if not intrinsically, familiar with.
Yep, I'm guilty of all of those titles.
So this is going to be an interesting conversation. We're going to go over some of the things that are happening in the design process with Oath arriving soon, Root getting a new expansion coming out. We're going to talk about some of the things you're working with your personal company. Pax Premier just arrived. John Company, the second printing or the second edition, is still in the works. I believe the Kickstarter hopefully will be arriving because I'm excited about it. And then at the end of this, for any of you who are listening who are designers or creators just interested in the industry as a whole, I'm going to ask some questions around this space, you know, what you've learned over the past few years of working in this space, what you've brought with you from kind of your past career as a scholar and the game design or game industry as a whole, where you think it's going and what advice you might have for some individuals. That being said, like I said, this is a brand new format. This is an interview format or a conversation, to say the least. And I really haven't done a lot of these on the podcast. It's weird doing something that is audio based and audio only. So for any of you listening, please swing over to the Facebook group, the Quackalope Podcast, or quackalope.com, and let us know your thoughts on this interview style. We're hoping or planning to do maybe one of these a month until we start ramping up. I've sourced a variety of questions from the Patreon community to let them have a voice in this dialogue and discussion, and we're probably going to be reaching out to a variety of publishers, you know, artists, designers, and industry professionals so that we can have a in-depth conversation about this space. But all that being said, let's get to the interesting part, which is talking about you, or at least me asking questions and then stepping to the side while you give me thorough answers. Cole, could you give me a rundown of, and I enjoy having people talk about themselves, not in a braggadocious way, but just in a, what are important moments in your career or your profession that have led to where you are now? For you, what have been the highlights looking back?
Ooh, okay, that's an interesting way to frame it. I was about to start telling you about my childhood. That's not the answer to that question.
I'll take your childhood. Well, I mean, that might be important as well. But I find most people pose this question as, tell me the story about how you got here. And that's interesting, but I assume you have a scripted answer.
I do.
I want the pinpoints.
All right, well, I'm going to throw my script to the ground and give you the pinpoints. Because it is, like, just a few moments. I mean, it's really...
Sure.
It's really just a few lucky moments. So one of those moments was when I was younger. I remember playing a game. We used to play a lot of Risk. And I remember one day we were on playing it on the porch of the house I grew up in. And after the game was over, we just started making up rules. We started like building little Risk variants, and we wanted to sort of build in like what would an alliance system look like in Risk, and would you need different victory conditions? And I mean, what we were doing was kind of game jamming. And I remember being so excited by that conversation. I was probably a freshman in high school around this time, and going upstairs and like writing a bunch of like goofy ideas in my notebook about what I wanted to do with Risk. And then all of that design energy didn't really go anywhere. As I went through high school, I got really interested in books and politics, and I wanted to be a reporter for a while. I went to college. But I happened to be playing a lot of Twilight Imperium in those years. And I found a group in Bloomington, Indiana that was playing Twilight Imperium, and I joined them. And they had actually done some playtesting for Fantasy Flight. And so they loved tinkering with their designs. And they were good at it. They really had a lot of follow through. I remember they actually had a really robust set of variants they used when they played Battlestar Galactica that made the game so sublime. And I have not played Battlestar Galactica since I played it with that group, because they had such carefully calibrated variants. And so I think about like a lot of those games and the conversations around those games as being kind of important moments. When I moved to Austin, I lived in this little apartment complex in North Loop that was right across the street from an old game store called Great Hall Games. And at Great Hall Games, I walked in, and you know, every game store is different, but a lot of game stores are alike in pretty critical ways, right? You walk in and you kind of see like the Asmodee section. And that's most of the game store.
That classic right, Asmodee,
you know,
section.
You're going to see the Days of Wonder games, the Catan, the, you know, that kind of stuff.
Wall of Dice.
Wall of Dice. There'll be some D&D books. This game store was so different from that because they had all of their games as if it were a bookstore with just the side showing. And it was because they had so many, and they had a selection that went back 10, 15 years. I remember walking in, and one of the first games I pulled off the shelf was this old game Confucius, which is like a Euro from maybe like 2004 or something. And it was just sitting in that. I mean, it'd probably been on that shelf for a decade. And they had lots of old war games, even games from the 90s and older Euros, a bunch of Leo Colvini games. And I walked to the back room because it was a Friday night and there was open gaming. And a bunch of people were playing High Frontier, which had just come out, Phil Eklund's High Frontier, which I'd never heard of. I'd never heard of this person before. And they were all playing. So I sat down and played High Frontier and had never played a game like that before. And then I think the week following, I played Lords of the Spanish Main. And that especially the play of Lords of the Spanish Main, which is a pirate game, it was so amazing. There were so many ideas in it. It wasn't just a game. It was like it was just this immense world that you could operate in. And that experience, the experience of playing on Friday nights at Great Hall, got me thinking about design in a way that made me want to do design work. If I were to pick kind of like one more spot, one more critical moment. So like, you know, sure. that moment at Great Hall got me designing history games and talking to people who were working on history games and getting much more deeper into the community. And then the last moment was I'll give you a kind of a quick pair. I finished my dissertation in the summer. I finished my last draft. And it
subtle brag there.
Y'all, I finished a dissertation. It was really hard. It was really hard. If you're thinking about doing it, maybe don't. But I liked it, yeah, but also like, it's rough. Anyway, it was a Friday afternoon, and I had finished at like maybe 1 or 2 in the afternoon. And I got a text from a friend who said, "Hey, this guy, Patrick Leader, I know you like Vast. He's looking for a game developer." He posted on Twitter. And I was filled with nervous energy having just submitted this 200-odd page document. And so I wrote a quick cover letter and sent it to Patrick. And Patrick wrote me back that night. And it began this conversation, which eventually led to me being at Gen Con with him about a month later. And I remember walking around Gen Con before the hall opened. And I had been to lots of cons before, but I had never been there before a hall opens. And it reminded me of being in stage crew as a kid. And it was this wild feeling of thinking about, like, this wasn't a show I was attending. This was a show I was going to help run in my small way. And these were like everybody, we were all peers, and I was maybe part of this industry now. And it was just this really incredible, strange feeling. And I happened to walk by the Fantasy Flight's booth, and they had the new edition of Twilight Imperium. And I thought, I haven't played this game in a long time, but I kind of want it because it's, you know, it seems like I want to understand what this is. And they're now like a peer in the market. Like, I want to know what they're doing. And I remember buying TI, and it was like 50% a nostalgia purchase and 50% like a professional purchase. And it was the first time in my life I had really like ever bought a game for that kind of reason. And I remember carting it back to the hotel, or actually I hid it in our booth for a while and then had to cart it back to the hotel. But that whole con, like when I got home from it, I remember opening up TI and I just started learning about game production on a much bigger scale. And I remember punching it and going through the components And looking at the decisions they made about the bleed of the tokens and about how they had chosen to assemble the rule books. And I think in some ways I'm still in that last moment. Like that last moment didn't really stop. It just kind of like opened up and it's kept stretching out over the past 3 years or so.
So you still have a industry fascination in some way, a nostalgia for design and a love for the space, but then also a fascination for production and the choices and the business side behind the scenes. Is that accurate?
Yes. I mean, so we got, it's one of the things I love. So I'm right now, I'm in studio and there's only a few people here because of COVID.
Sure.
So, but we're all in the same bubble. So it's been really nice because I can have lunch with these people. We all have to be very rigorous about our contacts with folks. But it also
for
means
sure.
that like these people are in our bubble. So I get to have lunch with
it's exactly the same. Yeah. I mean, it's exactly the same way that we've been operating here. We have two or three people that have the luxury of working from home, and we extend risk in a very limited and mediated
right.
and way.
So I get to have lunch with my coworkers and friends, and it's a tremendous yeah. privilege to be able to do that. But it only works if we are all very careful. But
absolutely.
It allows me to do one of my favorite things, which is when I get a game, I can take it to the office and we can play it. And this afternoon, we played Piers Vester's Polynesia, a game I've been excited about for a long time. He designed The King is Dead, which is one of my favorite games. And this is like his
yep.
newer title. And it was so, and I'm quite compelled by it, but I don't know fully what I think yet. But what I will say is when we opened it up, we just started like critiquing and noticing all the little production decisions. Like how many art pieces did they commission when they did this game? How did they lay out this token sheet? And I love that stuff. I love that like attention to detail. And whenever we have a new staff member join, one of the things that I always try to do is make sure they're having lunch with us when we're doing things like that. And they get in the mix that they can start saying like, oh, why did they do the board fold that way? Not that way. Because that's the craft of game production. And it's really
For sure.
hard to learn unless you have somebody who knows a lot more than you teaching you.
Yeah. Instill that interest and love and desire, but do it in a way that, yeah, gives them someone to be mentored by. So we have some pinpoints. We have your sort of journey to this point, which I thoroughly enjoyed. But now I do want you to brag just a little bit. What are you the most excited about or proud about or over the past 3 or 4 years that you've been in this space? What have been some of the accomplishments you genuinely love people being aware of?
Well, I'm tremendously proud of Root because, you know, there's a breakout hit every year, and it's never the kind of design space that I attempt, right? I think that there are some designers who, when you look at their work, you think you want to design a Spiel game. I always think about Kanitsa in this way, whose designs I absolutely respect. But I also think he understands the Spiel committee, and he knows what it means. Or like Kramer and Kissling would be in the same group. Like, I mean, obviously, I think Kramer has more Spiel wins than anybody. And when you see how they design, like they're very tapped into a market. And I'm tapped into a market too. It's just a different market. It's not the kind of market that's going to be in under German Christmas trees, right? And
sure.
So there's always going to be a breakout hit. It's not really an area that I feel like I'm never trying to like read the tea leaves and figure out how the breakout hit's going to be. But Root was a breakout hit. It was huge. It's allowed Patrick to build a studio. It's allowed everybody at the studio to have really good jobs with benefits and security. And those are all wonderful things. And I'm very happy it's done so well. And I feel very honored I was able to participate in it. But from a game theory, not theory, maybe game studies perspective, the part of me that designs historic games that are really interactive is so happy that such an interactive war game could still be a hit. And I remember Gen Con, for folks who've never been there, has horrible gaming spaces. It's like a horrible place to play a game. Great place to talk about games, to buy games, not a great place to play them. And so I remember walking out of the hall on the year that Root released, and there were all these people playing Root on the carpet, just like sitting around the table, throwing dice and shouting at each other. And I was so happy to see this very interactive, very no guardrails, old-fashioned design resonate with people who had never played a war game, maybe never played Risk. I have a lot of people approach me at cons who say, you know, I had a bad experience playing Risk with my brothers growing up. And I had never played a war game until I played Root, and we love it, and we play it all the time. And that there's no higher compliment than that. So I'm tremendously proud of it. And then the other thing that I would put kind of on that, and that same area is after a studio has a breakout hit, there is a very strong temptation to just publish more of the same. You know what works, you just try to really do it. And I really applaud Patrick's leadership in this regard, because I did not want to do that. I wanted to pace ourselves. I wanted us to do other designs. I still, if there's a big audience around Root, I want to service it. I want to make it a better and bigger title. I'm completely on board with that. But I want to make sure we don't lose like the radical kind of spunky energy and design ethos of the studio. And so when I first started pitching him Oath, he was so receptive to it. And Oath is an insane design. What I would usually say about Oath is that it's far too risky for any big studio and far too expensive for any small studio. There's never been a game that has been anything like Oath. And I am so happy that we were able to do it. I mean, it took a pretty full staff, the better part of about a year and a half to build it, which is an eternity. We could have built two more Root expansions for the price of this Oath. Heck, when we, part of my job description here at Leader is I help manage all of the assets of the creative team, all of the bandwidths, right? I try to make sure that we, like, the editor is talking to the artist, at the whatever. So we're all on the same page. And I just try to make sure the projects get done. I'm just a glorified project manager sometimes. And I love it. But when we started looking at our schedule for this year, it became really clear that we could have built four games and instead we built one Oath. And I am happy that we did it. I mean, I don't know how well the game will do, if it will do well at all, but it exists. And maybe some young designer is going to look at it and be like, well, I don't like this game, but it does this thing that's never been done before. And I think I can take that lesson and move it on. And if that happens, if we advance the state of the art in even a small way, Oath will have been worth it. And, I love it as it is right now. And it's been really fun to see people start to get it and play it. Not in person yet, but to play it on Tabletop Simulator.
Yeah, so I am going to dig into Oath here in just a moment. But I have one more question before we start getting to the designs and the games specifically. I've given you a chance to brag about yourself, but I also think in our space, one of the things that I love the most is the new designers, the new publishers, the new artists, the new content creators, the people that are sort of going to be cornerstones in 3 or 5 years, right? The scrappy ones that are trying to make it work. Who are you paying attention to that I and the audience may not be aware of? Who's on your radar right now?
Oh, what a good question. So who am I paying attention to right now?
And it could be anyone in the industry. I'm opening this up.
So, well, there are lots of like, this is a funny, I think like a lot of industries, there's like a weird short memory. And so there are a lot of designers, and actually one of them who I've already name dropped, but I'll name drop again, like someone like Colvini, who I think won some spiels, but whose games don't get played that much these days, is fabulous. And more people should be playing games that he's worked on. He has so many good games. I've been playing Carolinas lately, which is like his weird game about Charlemagne. I think it's great, but he is an older designer. You can find this stuff used. It's not really, I don't think the hobby is moving in his direction, but I do think more people should probably be playing his games. I am really excited by, the games I'm most excited about getting these days are, anything that Nate Hayden does. He, owns a small company called the Emperors of Eternal Evil. He made a game called Cave Evil. It's a very metal aesthetic. He just published a game which got like no fanfare called Rocky Mountain Man, which is a Oregon Trail style survival game.
I am glad I'm talking to you right now because that is awesome. Literally going to be the first thing I look up after
it's
this
so
conversation's
good.
Done.
It costs like $30. It has a great production.
And I have an unboxing, a unopened copy of Cave Evil that we have filmed and unboxed, ready to go to the channel soon.
Oh, it's Cave Evil is fabulous. Fabulous game. And then I absolutely love the work that Tom and Mary are doing at Hollenspiel. They are my go-to like favorite small publisher. I've obviously worked with them before. Tom is a designer without equal in the space. I think she's great. Her new stuff is absolutely wonderful. I've been playing The Vote a lot recently, which I think is quite good. And one of the other things I like about Tom's model is that their company allows the elevation of voices that may not have another way into the publishing space. They publish a lot of first-time designers, and it's a great venue for people who want to work in historic games. And I just encourage a lot of people to check out their venture. It's called Hollenspiel. It's all print on demand, so you can, you know, it's pretty easy to find their games, and I think they're fantastic.
Very nice. I love that. I love because everyone has their thumb in different areas of this community, and finding little gems or secrets oftentimes is as simple as just asking someone that's paying attention. Because we're still a scrappy little industry. We still have so much room to grow and develop. All that being said, what rabbit hole do you want to go down first? Do we want to talk about Root and what's coming out next? Or do you want to talk about Oath and it arriving soon?
Oh, okay. Well, we should do things chronologically and talk about Oath first.
Okay.
So what?
So
yes,
I do have a Patreon question around this specifically.
Fire away.
From Magato, how does it feel when nearing the release of a game like Oath? Are you nervous? Are you thinking about what's next? Are you excited for the reception or sort of terrified of it? What's going through your head? Because we're probably, 5 months out from potential delivery?
Yeah, it's a little less than that. So I think that if backers started getting this at the end of March or early April, that is a reasonable. It's really hard to predict timelines right now.
Of course, of course.
It could be earlier. It could more likely be later. I mean, there's just the stuff that our poor operations team is doing on the logistics side is Herculean. So a couple funny things happen during the end of production. So we finished all of the Oath stuff in October. And really, I finished a lot of the Oath stuff in September, but like the actual pre-press on a project like Oath takes about 3 to 6 weeks. There's just a lot of stuff that has to be checked over. We're using a factory that's very rigorous in their pre-press. There were some things about Oath's files that made it a little harder to take it through that process. So, you know, the design was like pretty close to being done by in August. We kind of like soft locked it, and then we started moving things into pre-press, and then various locks. I won't go into all the details of how it works, but it took about 6 weeks. So by late October, we had locked it in, and at that moment, a tremendous weight is lifted. In fact, we have a policy of studio closures where at certain times after we turn a big project, Patrick just shuts the studio down for a week so everybody can rest. And I remember like that week was so divine. I like went on bike rides. I just completely let Oath sort of leave my mind. And I have not been thinking about Oath. I don't think I've played it maybe once since that like time.
Interesting.
And it's totally out of my mind. And part of that is just, you're very saturated in the project. I've been paying so much attention to every little word and I'm exhausted by it. And so the period where a game is under production is this little break that lets you kind of fall in love again. And then when the game starts arriving and I have to start thinking about like, oh, I'm going to have to demo this at conventions or something like that.
Sure.
I'm ready to get excited again because I have the necessary distance. So mostly during this period, I'm not thinking about Oath. There's a copy of Oath like that, you know, we have our pre-production copies and the late stuff. Like we could play it if we wanted to right now, but we have to keep it for a variety of very boring reasons. But mostly, I am not like letting myself kind of get into it. And then what will happen usually is the night before a convention, usually the release convention, we'll play a game to just kind of remember how it works. And usually, and I imagine this will happen with Oath too, it fires everyone back up. And then we all get very excited.
That's cool.
We start going into it. And you know, one of the things with Oath is I nervous is like a funny word because I is a funny way to describe it. I will say that when it gets its first reviews, I'm definitely going to like page down to the bottom And I just want the last little, just tell me the tell me if it was good or not. Like I have, I mean, I'm a human like any other person. I want to know if someone likes
that
something
final
or doesn't.
Sentence. I'm just all gonna, this I'm being zoom, said, I'm just going to zoom. I love this game.
Right. I'm just going to zoom to the end. And then of course later I'll start the video over and watch the whole thing. And, you know, and it's so funny. I remember when Shut Up and Sit Down did a review of Root and, you know, their review dropped, the review has like a pivot where it starts very, very positive and then it pivots sure. to being like a little lukewarm. And everybody on the creative team, it was very clear that the video dropped and we all watched just the last 2 minutes. And then we were like, oh no, I'm like, sorry about, sad about this. Or, you know, maybe we disagree with them there or whatever. And then everybody on the operations team had started from the beginning and thought that it was very positive. And so 5 minutes after this video dropped, we were all arguing about whether or not it was good or bad. And it became abundantly clear that we had all just watched different parts of the video. So like you get nervous about it. My general sense about Oath is if we sell through the first print run, and it shows an audience that likes it, I'm good. I will be sad if we don't sell through the first print run. But if the game, you know, if it takes off and we have to do a second or third print run, like that's wonderful. And I would be delighted to spend more time like living in Oathland. But all that stuff is like so far out of my control when it comes to this stage of the process. I just end up paying attention to other things.
So let's dig in here. For those that aren't overwhelmingly familiar with Oath, or at least what Oath has become over the, you know, 6 or 7 months of development since Quackalope last covered it, give me a rundown. Give me a brief description of theme and mechanics, and then let's highlight 2 or 3 elements that may have developed or changed over the course of this last year. Things that you're really, really excited about when it comes to the systems in this game.
So Oath began with a kind of problem, which is it possible to play a game that changes how you play it that isn't a legacy game in the traditional sense? That was like the problem. Because when I think about legacy games, I think about them being like television shows. They have seasons. I mean, Pandemic is seasoned, right? It's enumerated like as if it were a TV show. And I thought, like, is there another way of doing this? Could you make a game that there are all these systems in game. I'm going to start off a little high concept, but it's important because there's always, when you're doing game design, most of the systems you're building at the very end of the game, if the game continued another round, it'd be just really, really stupid. And that's true of even really good games. Like if you're playing Vast and you're playing the Knight, by the end of the game, the Knight is very, very strong, but you don't have very many turns left to be strong. If you did have a lot of turns left, Vast would not be good, but you know, Vast works because of that tension. So I started thinking about this as a design problem. Like, how do you make a game where the systems adapt, but also like there's a fluidity to them so that they don't like, you don't have those kind of endpoints. So I started thinking about that from the abstract. And then I also started thinking about civilization games. And one of the things about Civ games is that usually you're building to an endpoint, right? You got to get the rockets, you've got to get the tanks or whatever. And so there's this big arc that is already mapped out for you. I think Tapestry is like the best example of this, where the arc of your civilization is like mapped at the very start of the game. It was our developer, Nick Brockman, said this, such a smart thing about Tapestry when he first saw the board. He was like, oh, I see what Jamie did. He just arranged all of the actions that you need to take in a line. So it has a very like clear, like
interesting.
Linearity to
that's
it.
An interesting way to, that's an interesting way to think yeah, about it.
Yeah. And it, you know, there's obviously more going on with Tapestry than that, but I think that kind of closed and linear character, I think that actually lines up with my sense of Tapestry. So with Oath, I wanted to throw all that away and say, what do you do? Like, how do you build a game that changes? And so the conceit of Oath is that Oath is a generational game. Every game is a generation. And one player basically starts as the king or emperor or empress ruling the land. And their reign is either going to continue or it's not. And the state that they're part of is either going to crumble or it's going to expand. And the core conceit of the game is that when you win a game of Oath, the territory you control, your land, the character of that land, is the starting map for the next game. And that was the conceit. It wasn't any more complicated than that. And then it led to all these problems of like, well, how much can a game even change? What, like, how big of a game space do we need to design here? And so the way Oath ends up working is every game, there are these four different victory conditions, and one of them is active, and the others are subdued. And when you're playing the game, you're trying to win on that victory condition, but you might discover the other victory conditions as you play. And if you win with that other victory condition, it will change the victory condition for the next game that you're playing. And then depending on how the game goes, the game's deck and the world will kind of slowly draft. So it's sort of like you're playing a campaign draft, but it's occurring on this really large scale. And I had this rule that I posted up on my desktop, which says, I want players to care less about who won and more about how someone won. And so, you know, if I see at the end game, because I've been thinking about the kingmaking problem, and one of the things that always bums me out about board games in general is that the question of how a thing is won is really important. Like, if you win a game by pushing the whole kingdom into anarchy and tearing everything down, then the next game should have to happen in that chaos. Or if you win the game by building a very stately thing, the next game is going to be stately. And so that's all kind of like high level stuff going on, but it does do all those things. So, you know, the development of the game was really interesting because if I listen to myself talk about Oath or read what I wrote about Oath a year before it was done, generally it is that thing. You know, like it didn't change that much, but in the particulars, it changed so much. I went through many different combat engines.
I mean, I've seen the iterations and even the core that we played during that Kickstarter, there were full sections and systems removed by Midsummer that just didn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
So let me poke you here, because we don't need to go through every single pinpoint, but from what I remember, from the experiences I've had with an outdated version of this game, I remember a very, very interesting abstract territory control. I remember mild asymmetric powers. I remember bidding and negotiation when it came to deciding if you're going to be a citizen or an exile. And then, of course, that legacy system, that storytelling that the game does in its own organic pattern. When the current version of this game gets to the table, what one or two elements have really been brought up or dialed up to the surface? What type of game is this now?
So it's the same kind of game, but, and here's where the rub is.
It's a big but.
It's a big but. Every game is filled with abstractions. You're always making things where you say, look, I can't tell you exactly what it's like to punch a goblin, but like if I include a die that might break a bone in your hand, that goblin punch is then like being more closely modeled in the system. It has a little bit more heft. I mean, and you guys know Kingdom Death, which is like a masterclass in where do you want to expend your mechanical energy terms of what you're modeling.
Weight of experience.
Yeah. And the way that like you can compare something like Kingdom Death to something like Gloomhaven, because they are both spending their mechanical points in different kinds of narrative pools and have very different consequences for that reason. So every system in any game, you could put on a little grid and you could say, I want this to be more closely modeled. This can be a little bit abstract. If I were to say one thing about the development of Oath, it was anything that was abstract, we tried to pull down into the model, the system of the game. We wanted everything to hit and to have like real feelings to it. Right. So some examples. We retooled all the combat cards in the game because originally I had built this rock, paper, scissors system where one suit could be good at another suit. And I was kind of trying to be cute and model like how StarCraft works or something like that. But what we found was that often it just felt like abstract, like I was collecting different types of Pokemon, but I wasn't really explaining why a grass type might be good against whatever grass is good against in Pokemon. I can't remember. So I wanted like to actually figure out, well, you know, for example, if water is good against fire, I need the water to like put out the fires, right? So we went through all the cards in the game, and I'll give you just a couple examples. So there used to be this card, like Wolves, which was a beast card that was good against you know, like order or something. And we changed it to have an active power that if you like use one of your secrets, which is kind of like the magic currency of the game, on the wolves, it allows you to kill war bands that are traveling with other players. And the idea is like, no, that's you sending out your wolves to go hunt people that are traveling, that are currently like not like at home. And it felt instantly, it felt so much cleaner. Like it was just, it had a lot more punch to it. Or there was this card Bear Traps, which used to be a beast card counter, which we just changed it to be like more of like a landmine. So it was something that a lot of different things would trigger. So we went through like all 60 of the combat cards and completely rebuilt their powers to avoid abstractions that didn't have a good storytelling punch. Along a similar line, we took what used to be the court and fashion system, which was this kind of like portfolio manipulation, strange, very Euro-y, Rococo system, got rid of it, and instead made that victory condition about the control of relics, which allowed us to design items. And I love the item design because it's a place where I've been playing a lot of Spelunky and Caves of Cud and thinking about how useful items are if you design them in a way that is modular and unexpected. So, and here's what I mean by that. There's an item in Oath called the Whistle, which if you use, calls another player to your location. And I, you know, this whistle, you know, it's funny. It's a funny item, but it can be used in lots of different ways. It's not like, the whistle isn't like plus one to whistling, or you know what I mean? And so we really, like, I try to avoid that so stringently. I'm like, I don't want to see any nonsense plus one longswords in this game. I want to see a whistle that if you use it, calls a player to you. And what ended up happening is once we had the category of relic, there were all these other card powers and ideas we had that we couldn't quite figure out what to do with. And then it's like, oh, well, that's actually a relic. So in a very small example there is the Chancellor has all these rules around citizenship. And it was giving us this problem because we had all this text on the Chancellor's board explaining how citizenship worked. And it was just fugly. And I didn't like how it looked. And it was a lot of text to throw at a player. And then one of our playtesters or a group of them suggested that, why isn't that on a relic? And so we created the Grand Scepter, which the Chancellor starts with, which is an item that gives it the power to make citizens. And now that it's an item, I can use my relic thief to steal your Grand Scepter and then grant my own citizens. And so
that's ridiculous.
It like leans into the insanity of the game. I mean, I think like, yeah. I mean, look, I try to not brag about stuff I've worked on, but I think Oath is the most narrative driven conflict game I've ever played. The people, like the sentences that people find themselves saying when they play Oath are out of their mind. And I love it. And so, you know, we just kept leaning
Which
into it.
For me is so exciting. Cause I mean, one of the things that we did that we actually experimented with for the first time when we were covering Oath for the Kickstarter was recapping and writing and documenting the story that we just experienced as we led into the next game. And back then, like you said, there were a lot of elements that were more abstract, more floaty, that didn't boil down into systems, right? We had to search for that story a little bit harder. And because I love story and flavor and lore, we did that. But the thing that you've emphasized is bringing those things down to earth, is creating systems that reward and enhance that storytelling element, heightens my excitement tenfold. I do have one very important question, though. Do you believe flavor text is a mechanic?
It is not. Well, that's interesting. Flavor text is part of the game. I probably wouldn't think about it as a mechanic, but it is part of the game. And it's not something I use. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with it. I think there are some games that use flavor text really, really well. I'm gonna make a slight pivot from maybe what position I thought I had. I'm a big believer in flavor text. However, for me, flavor text is the only flavor text I use is the name of something.
Sure.
So names are very, very, very important.
I think that counts.
I think a name of anything, a name of an item, a name of a card, a name of a region. It's a critical thematic component because what you're doing is you're giving the name of an action you're giving players the language they're going to use to talk about the game. It's really almost the fringe of what you can do as a designer, right? Because, well, you know, one thing that I talked about with Kyle, right, when the artist of the game, right when we were starting out was, and this sounds preposterous, but I had an idea of how I wanted people to maybe talk about Oath way before we had a game. I would like imagine people like chatting about what just happened and be like, okay, I need this conversation to look a certain way, and I'm going to try to build this whole game so that it leads to those kinds of conversations. And a big part of that is getting your terms right. Now, in my own design practice, I think I avoid proper nouns wherever possible, and I'm always searching in language for words that are evocative but specific. And so, like, the whistle as an item. And I love Kyle's illustration. It's not like, I'm not going to give it theme or lore. It's the players who have to invest it with lore. Right.
Sure.
Oath is a big box of things that you are going to give a history to. I don't get to give the history. I don't get to tell you how that thing got made, because, you know, you could have built the Ancient Forge and built it in one way, your game, and that thing could exist for a long time. And so when we were naming cards, we would do these editorial passes. So, you know, we have this big list of cards, and we would go through and have card meetings about once a week. And we would go like, oh, let's do 20 cards. And we'd go through, we'd mark them up, and then we'd put them out. We'd play them for a week or two, and then we'd have another card meeting. And about halfway through the project, we started really focusing on names and trying to be like, oh, this one's too specific. This one's like way too general. What does that even mean? Right. And so, you know, again, the reason why I'm using the example of the whistle is that that's just an ordinary word, but I like the way it sounds. And I like how there isn't another relic that's a musical. Well, there's a drum, but, you know, there is a simplicity to it. It isn't overly freighted. I wouldn't want to make a lute or something, because that's like, that's touching on too many like symbols of bards. I don't really like that. I want something a little more primeval. So the fact that the instruments in the game are whistles and drums, very important. I mean, there are people playing lutes, I should say, in the art, but they're not called out by name, right? And then, you know, speaking of other card names, now that I'm thinking about that, like, there's a card Tavern Songs, which like has that the right degree of specificity. Like, I don't want to say anything else, because I want there to be enough ambiguity that the players can use that sort of like language unit in a lot of different combinations.
So what I've heard is a confirmation.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I think it's complicated. I think it's complicated.
If I'm willing to extend the definition of flavor text into those elements, into titles and names, and even in some way, I would stretch it to artwork, in terms of world building and design, but that would get even more fiddly. But let's say I extend the definition of flavor text to those titles. I feel like so. And the reason I'm asking this is because, as far as I'm concerned, flavor text is my favorite mechanic and the most important when designing a game. But, you know, uneducated opinion.
Well, here's what I'll say. Like, so it depends on what you mean by the game, because I think that If I'm thinking about what makes a game tell stories, it's the alchemy between the box and all the things inside the box and the people gathered around the table. And every element of production can lend itself to those ends or can inhibit those ends, and including a game mechanism, including the name on a card or a piece of flavor text, right? Now, if I'm just trying to understand what a game is doing mechanically, then all of the production stuff immediately falls away. So I kind of like, I'm a big fan of like always having two definitions for everything, especially when we're getting into conversations about taxonomy, because I think that like I could build a version of Oath that would be totally abstract and would be exactly the same game. It would certainly be Oath, but the version that, but if I'm talking about the kind of narratives that we're going to generate, the kind of experiences we're trying to curate, then things like flavor text, art, production, every little element, those all have a seat at the table. And frankly, in that, with that lens in mind, the name of a card is just as important as what the card does. So I'll give you your cake, but I won't quite let you eat it.
we're going to have to continue digging into that at some point in a future conversation, because I keep peppering why my theory exists, and I never quite, you know, spend 3 hours debating it or discussing it. I love those little insights to help inform my own argument. All that being said, super excited to have Oath arrive at our doorstep to bring it to the channel. I know there's a lot of people that are excited to see Quackalope do a campaign, and we will be doing that as soon as possible. But there's another big thing on your horizon, root expansion. We have badgers and rats and potentially some balance tweaks coming for two players with little minor factions that you can weigh options in control. I mean, this is a game that, like you said, hit it big. I mean, has done incredibly well, and every expansion afterwards has iterated on that success in a very, very, I know, strategic and purposeful way on your part. It's not just adding something into the core box for the sake of selling copies. It has to function and work and enhance the game. And I would argue that with the Corvid Conspiracy and with the Underground Duchy and that Partisan and Vagabond deck, I now play an experience route in a way that is vastly different from what I originally did with that core box. I think I've I have basically retired that original deck and replaced it with the Partisan and Vagabond one, just because it has so much more experience in it. It has so much more depth in it from the game's been around longer. People have fed into it and read into it, and there's more to live with. So give me an insight. What's happening with this expansion, and where are we currently sitting?
So you're right that Root has grown into something that is so beyond what that core box is. We played a game yesterday that featured what was our faction mix? Lizards, Corvids, the Badgers, and the Duchy. None of those factions are in the core box. And it was a scream of a match. It was a great match.
That's interesting.
The Lizards took it. And I, you know, so the game has
that
grown.
That sentence is so interesting. None of those factions were in the core box. How mind-blowing is that?
Yeah, we didn't play with the deck.
That's like a new game.
Yeah, we didn't play with the original deck, and we played on the mountain map. So, like, outside of the dice, you know, we weren't using anything from the core box. You know,
and if you use the black dice, which are the most respectable ones,
of course,
because they're just stylistically, they're so nice. I mean, you could have legitimately retired that original box,
which
is the whole conceit of the game. That's the one. Like, wow.
Which is why, I mean, this is how Root has grown. So, you know, Root is a really fun project for people on staff to work on, because it's the project that we all get to help on. And it's very much an all hands on deck. What are you working on? What are you thinking about? What kind of Root games of Root have you been playing lately? What would you like to see in the box? So, you know, whereas Oath involved a lot of like headaches and like, you know, cloistering of the creative team and really trying to build something very difficult and technical. Root is like, whenever we work on Root, it's like, I feel like we're throwing a party for everybody on staff. We're like, okay, what are folks like, what are we excited by? But we have really high standards for wanting to put things in the game. One of the biggest standards we have is when a new faction is only good if it changes the nature of the game for everyone at the table. So you have to feel it. It can't just be like, oh, my guys, they're faster. It's like, that's not enough. It needs to somehow change the calculus for every player. So Patrick produced these new factions. He was the initial designer behind them. Josh Yearsley is doing a lot of the development, and Nick Brockman will be helping with development too. He did the development for Underworld. And we have two new major factions. They are the Warlord, or the Lord of the Hundreds. We're still figuring out the name. It's the Rat Warlord character, who is just so fun to play. He can set fires that spread around the woods randomly. He's got a special meeple, tons of warriors, has a great like punch to him. You really feel like you're commanding a marauding army. It's lovely.
Now,
and then on
that
the
was
other
sort of
side,
the question,
we have these, yeah.
That was sort of the question I was going to lead to, because I remember the Corvid change so much between application and the playtest that I did during the first printing, or first, you know, during the print and play during the Kickstarter campaign. So what I'm actually curious about from your perspective, and I know there's quite a few people in the design of this, but from your perspective, what is the feeling that these two factions, what do you want to evoke? And sorry for interrupting you there. Continue on that route, Warlord. But I'm really curious about the way they should impact the game.
The question about feeling is really important for us because we look at all the root factions that exist now, and we're only going to add to that roster if they offer a new kind of feeling to the game. And so with the Warlord faction, it was really important that they have the spirit of a single army. You're dealing with problems of like unit cohesion, and that you really do feel like an invader. The Warlord's victory conditions force him to have rule clearings where there are no other pieces. Now, a lot of root, the different factions overlap. So like, you know, it's a pretty cosmopolitan motley place, right? But when the Warlord's in the game, they are carving out a section of the board that is desolate. And so you really get like a very Sherman, like scorched earth policy kind of play style to it, which we
really
like.
Sounds entertaining.
Yeah, they're a little bit like they're the heel, right? They're going to be the bad guys of the game a little bit, although you can feel sympathetic for them often too. And that's the charm of Kyle's art. The Badgers are completely different. They are sort of like the major faction equivalent of the Otters. Their whole thing is that they're very defensive, and they're trying to recover these relics that spawn up around the map, and they're trying to bring the artifacts. They're trying to bring them back to their outposts, and they benefit. They offer things to other players. And they're all these, like, basically they add escort missions into the game where you can find one of these things and you can try to deliver it back to the outpost to gain points. They just have a very different character, and they're really like oil and water in some lovely ways. And so because we wanted two factions that really contrasted against each other. Now, one of the nice things about these two factions is they both have a lot of warriors, which means there's so many more two-player options. And when we started working on the expansion, Patrick and I talked a lot about who wanted to design what and what things we wanted to work on, because I've got some factions I would love to finish at some point. But I told Patrick that the thing that I want to do more than anything else in Root is I want to think about the two-player game hard and try to make it better. And I also want to think about setup and drafting, because one of the things that surprised us with Root is that a whole competitive scene has just kind of sprung up. There was a massive Root winter tournament that just wound up a few weeks ago.
Now, is that through Space Cats and Peace Turtles, or are there a few other people working on that?
So the Woodland Warriors, which is now the Leader Games official Discord, they had a huge winter tournament that they ran all by themselves.
Very cool.
And then we have another Space Cats and Peace Turtles tournament that is also running.
Right now. Gentlemen of a crew. I love those two.
They're so charming, and I love their audience, and they're really great, really fun to hang out with. But they're also running a Root tournament. And so I have spent a lot of time talking with people who have worked in those tournaments and talking with players who are kind of competitive level Root players, much better Root players than I am probably. And just thinking about, like, what does the game need? And I started, like, looking around at other game lines that had a lot of expansions. So, like, my wife and I play a lot of Command & Colors. We used to play a lot. And we talked about Command & Colors or Cosmic Encounter, you know, the kind of games that, like, stick around. And I think this is maybe because I'm still a little bit of an academic at heart. Like, I want to know, like, what's the water I'm swimming in? What do other games do when they get to this point? Well, a lot of games do the easy thing, which is to make the expansions very compartmental. Carcassonne's like the best example, right? You never want to play Carcassonne with all the expansions. It's just not designed to do that. Instead, you pick the one. You pick the one. Or with Command & Colors, it's like you pick the scenario. So the scenario is doing the work of deciding what you're going to play with. And when my wife and I were playing a lot of Command & Colors Napoleonics, we would get the Russian expansion, and then we would play all the Russian scenarios, and then we put it in its box and put it on the shelf. And we probably haven't touched that box in years. And then there's the Cosmic Encounter model, which says when you buy a Cosmic Encounter expansion, shuffle it in. I don't even know the names of the Cosmic Encounter expansions. I've got most of them, right? Invader, maybe something like that. But I know that when I play Cosmic, I might deal one of those aliens out. I would hardly know what expansion it's from.
You never separate them again.
You
absolutely.
Never separate them. So I thought, if I can do it, I want Root to be like Cosmic Encounter. And so that led to, so we're always looking for ways to improve the game and to strengthen it and to do, and really we do that because it's such a living thing. I mean, you know, our audience wants us to really invest in the game and we want to help our, you know, we want to do right by our audience. And so I looked, the one place where Root's rules were not well equipped for expansion was the setup rules. They were written with thinking that there would only ever be six factions. Not really.
Right now it's A, B, C, D. Things get weird. There's exceptions for stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
So they're just not really built for that kind of stuff. So what I did was I went through and completely reimagined how setup worked. And so now what will happen is we will keep the existing setup framework for anybody who wants to use it. However, the expansion is going to come with a small deck of setup cards. And you use those setup cards to randomly determine map and faction mix. And so like when you open up your copy of Root, the very first thing you should grab if you're an advanced player, if you've played more than a few times, you grab your little deck of setup cards. And it removes the old Reach system. And you deal out a pool of factions, and then players draft them. And in fact, as they draft those factions, they set up instantly. And this has allowed me to totally change how the setup works. So now we have like a homeland system that I'm currently fleshing out, which basically, like if you want to play the cat and you want to put your keep in the middle of the map, you can. And there are, you know, like I kind of got rid of like the old corner system and how you'd get like, oh, I'm playing the moles and I'm picking, I guess I have to be in this corner because this is where the game tells me they have to start. That's gone. Now it's like I have to be at least one clearing away from someone else's homeland, but I've got three different options of where I could set up. And maybe I wanted to pick them in the draft earlier so I would have even more options about where to set up. And all of this is at the service of making it so players have an ease of access to all of their Root content. That when you sit down to play Root, you shuffle up those setup cards, you deal them out as the rules tell you to deal them out, and it will tell you like, hey, this game, we're doing, you know, badgers, lizards, corvids, moles, and those are the four. And I think the one that didn't get picked in that mix was the Woodland Alliance. Nobody picked the Woodland Alliance, which is fine. Someone could have. And so then that setup animates things. And then what we've done too, so the setup system is then linked to the minor, to what I've been calling the minor faction system. They may get a better name later. And what the minor faction system does is there are certain, so when I was building the Exiles and Partisans deck, there were certain powers I couldn't touch. So for example, the Eerie rules when there are ties. That's a great power. I can't put that on a craftable card because if the Eerie is in that game, there's a conflict. Like what player gets to use it, right? You don't know. And so then I have to write a rule that says the Eerie power trumps the card or whatever. It's dumb. So what I did was I designed these minor factions, and the way they work is they crop the draft. So at the beginning of the game, you deal three of these minor factions out. And if the Eerie, every minor faction is paired with a major faction. And if the Eerie minor faction is drawn, it won't be one of the major factions to choose. And then depending on the player count, every minor faction has two sides. It can be played as a kind of a large or a small side. The small side is like a cute power. The large side is like a marauding army with its own meeples and a little box that will hold those meeples, hopefully, or a bag or something. And what this does is when you play at a lower player count, I might be playing, you know, cats versus Eerie, but there is a vagabond running around in the woods. There is a weird little like group of lizards in one corner of the board. And then we got to deal with like these Dutchy people who keep drilling holes through things. And those become things that players can buy and kind of bid on with this influence system. And it gives the two-player game so much life. Because now you feel like the world is so populated.
The promise of that is honestly one of the things that I'm the most intrigued and excited about what you're working on currently. And I know things will shift and change, you know, between now and when we finally get into our hands. But the idea of you taking a step back and saying, how can we focus all of our insight, all of our guns on this two-player system and enhance it and bring it back up to life? Because right now, the biggest way to accommodate for that is using one of the automated systems, the bot systems.
Right. So there's a very interesting thing here, because when we started working on this, our production manager came over to me and said, like, hey, are you worried that like this is going to remove the bots from the mix, or it's going to, you know, some people are going to want to do this and not play with the bots? And the bots are really quite different. So one of the things that the bots give players that this system can't is the bots do make it feel like you're playing a four-player game. Now, that means sometimes you Absolutely. And the person you're playing with need to go fight the third party, which is fun. And that, and sometimes what happens in the bots is that like the human players tear each other up, and then the second half of the game is like who's going to tear down the bot at the right time. And it's really interesting. The two-player with the minor factions does not feel like that. The two-player with the minor factions is a war game, capital W. Like, it feels very scrappy, and it's very zero-sum. And I think that is going to be very, very, very appealing for a portion of the people who play with the bots. But a lot of the people who play solo probably don't want that, because they do like the feeling of like trying to outfox an AI, right? So it's like, do you want to play against an AI that's really well-conceived, and Benjamin Strauss did a great job on their design, or do you want to play against the player sitting across from you? And, you know, I play a lot of war games with my wife, and there are some evenings where like, hey, let's not play something that's really aggressive, because I just don't want to like tangle with your mind for like the next hour and a half. And in those instances, I'm like, hey, let's, you know, we can do a root bot instead. So I think they are kind of different needs. The other thing about the minor factions too is that they work at every player count. So you always kind of use them if you are playing them. And they do things, they do really interesting things to the way the factions work. So one of my favorite interactions is the small side of the cats is the feline physician, which is the cat's hospital powers, but as a thing that can be bitted and fought over.
That's cool.
It is so good with the Corvids, because what it allows you to do is somebody goes to your plot token and kills all your guys at the plot token, and then you can use your field hospitals to save all of them. And so it has this, like, it does this really interesting, it just, the way the faction powers combine with all the other powers, it just unlocks this like really cool, like variable asymmetry that isn't in the game right now.
It's the element, like I was saying earlier. I mean, the Vagabond and Partisan deck has replaced our core deck because of that little bit, that extra mechanic, the flavor that it adds, where I get to utilize tunnels or have coffins, and you can feel like these characters, like this war is really happening across the board. And the idea of these minor powers emphasizing and bringing in a little bit more of that asymmetry, but in a way that is almost stitching everything together, is super, super exciting for me. Now, I do have a few questions,
sure.
And we can sprint through these. These are some Patreon questions. And then I want to dig into Whirligig just a little bit.
Yeah, of course.
So a few of these questions from my community on Root. From Zakua, what faction in Root do you play the most currently?
I am a huge Lizard stan. I remain a huge Lizard stan. They're my favorite ones to play.
Okay. Very nice. From Adunlachi, I'm probably getting these wrong, Agundalichi, favorite thing in the upcoming Root expansion?
I love the Warlord design. It's so much fun to play, and it adds just such vinegar to games. I'm really into it.
Okay.
Outside of that, probably the setup.
Okay. Timothy Snyder, and this is an interesting one, and I think the one that I will bridge into Whirligig here. Is it difficult to switch between working on a game about cute animals fighting each other and a game steeped in history like John Company or Pax Premier, or is the process basically the same even with the widely different themes?
The process is the same, but with working on history games, but it's much slower with Whirligig. So when I'm working on Whirligig stuff, it is in slow motion. And when I'm working on leader game stuff, it is as fast as I could possibly take it. And I can explain this very, very simply. When I come up with a new iteration for something at leader games, I can play it 5 times, 6 times, 8 times in a week without too much trouble. and it may take eight plays to see if something's good or not. With Whirligig, I'm only playing twice a week, so it might take me a month to make the same judgment. So that, on one hand, is sad, right? I want to be able to know the answer to these questions, but it takes me a long time. On the other hand, it's lovely because it means that in between all of those plays, I get to read history. I get to sort of like ruminate on ideas and think about things. It's just a much slower train. So, you know, Drew and I have been working on John Company for, oh gosh, a year, year and a half by now. And it's in testing and it's moving along and doing really, really well. And if I had been doing it full time, I might have been able to get it done in 3 or 4 months. The fact that it's gone so slow has been lovely because I reread William Dalrymple's The Anarchy. I'm working through a bunch of primary texts, you know, as I'm like reading in the evenings. And I feel very empowered by the slowness that I get to bless those history games with. So it's the same sort of work, though. Here's a way of explaining how similar the work is. After I finished Root, in my free time, I started working on doing the new version of Pax Premier. I rebuilt the file structure because I had learned a lot after Root, and I wanted to like have a good file structure. That file structure is basically the same file structure that all of my leader game stuff works under. Even Oath is structured basically with the same basic principles. So, you know, the projects help each other. Sometimes I will like fix something in John Company and then I'll be like, oh, I can fix something in Root because of something I just learned. It's the same kind of work. They're just done at two different paces.
Yeah. So Whirligig, for any of the people that don't know, is the company that you run that publishes your historical games with your brother. That is going to be where PAX Premier Second Edition just arrived from. Mm-hmm. And a game that I have played that I absolutely love. Jan and I both have been massive fans of it. And John Company, instead of being kickstarted right next to that second edition of PAX Premier, was actually delayed slightly.
Yeah.
Are we expecting to see John Company come into the swing this year sometime? Or is it sort of that ambient, when it's ready type of approach?
So my general rule for Whirligig stuff is because I can only give so many hours a week to it. We have to make sure our games are a lot closer to being done before we kickstart them. Because I can't, I can work a straight weekend and try to get something done, but I can't work 3 straight weeks to hustle and have something catch up. So
the context is different for sure.
Yeah. And there are certain things you can do in a 12-hour sprint that you can't do, unless you could sprint for a few weeks. So when we were preparing the second printing of Premier, there was so much demand. And Drew and I looked at where John Company was, and it just hadn't really started firing yet. We were still very much in a deconstructive stage where the longer we worked on the game, the more we were tearing it down, which is a very important stage.
It's also where I am emotionally, but I appreciate that.
Just the more I think about it, the sadder I get, right? he would come up. So, you know, he lives in Chicago. I live in St. Paul. It's 6 hours or so as a drive. He would come up. And we would work on John Company. And what was happening is that usually by the end of the weekend, the game would be less built. It would be further. We would realize like, oh, actually, that was a key system that we thought that part of the design was safe and strong. It's not. Well, okay, well, next week or, you know, in a month or something, we'll try again. So when we got to Premier, I sort of told Drew like, okay, I could really push this. I could work mornings on it, like I could get up at 5 or something and really crunch, and maybe we can get something to work. And Drew is like, what are you doing, Cole? This is stupid. This whole company is built on the premise that we don't have to rush. So let's just not rush. Let's do Premier alone. And then we'll do John Company when it's ready. And so we did Premier, and the second run was fabulous. We are almost out of it. I think we have like 2 copies left or something. So if you want a copy of Premier, we may be out by the time it's theirs. But we will be doing a third printing sometime in the spring. So Premier did really well. And then over the summer, things about John, I just kept working on John Company and things started finally clicking. And then in the early fall, we were playing it. It was like, it finally was able to be played again. I mean, we had taken a game that was perfectly playable and basically ruined it for a year to the point where it was not playable. And then finally, like in September, it got its heartbeat back. And then we just kept playing it and kept playing it. And then I played it in, I think, November or early, no, sometime in December, I played it with some reviewers. And I was like, yeah, I just, you know, it's not ready to show you guys, but I kind of want to see what your reaction. So we'll just play a game and see where we're at. And they really liked it. They really, really, really liked it. And they're like, this is great. Usually your games aren't this dumb. You show it. And I think what had happened is because Pamir what did so well, I was feeling very self-conscious and very much like, I do not want to show John Company to anybody until it is done. But after that play, we opened up to testing. And so we have a small, you know, there's maybe 15 or 20 people who have been helping me do some testing on it. And the core is very close to being done. And we've actually moved the testing to scenarios now. So we're still adjusting some things about the core of the game, but we are working on the scenarios. And I have hired all of the artists that need hired. And so they're working on their art and we are just kind of moving things along. If I guessed, I would guess that we're going to do Kickstarter and maybe sometime around March. And then hopefully it'll be in people's hands by the end of the year.
That's exciting.
I cannot wait for people to see it. It is going to be completely stunning.
Well, you already know there's a blanket agreement. I mean, we've signed documents, I believe, that state that Quackalope at any point in time is willing to pause everything we're doing to cover a Cole Worley title. So as far as I'm concerned, I certainly hope we get a chance to check it out. I'm super excited for the people that aren't aware of John Company, because I think I would venture to guess people may be more aware of you as a designer at this point.
Sure, they don't know what the weird history more, stuff I've done.
Some of the weird history stuff that you have. Could you give me a brief, superficial overview of why people might want to be paying attention to it?
So John Company, you know, every game I've done has felt very different from all the other games. And John Company is maybe like the most differenter, right? It is so out of its mind. John Company is the nickname. It takes its name from a nickname given to the British East India Company in the 18th century. And it is a game about India told from the British perspective. It is anti-colonial in its nature, which is to say it is a game about colonial dysfunction and about exploitation and about what happened in India. But it has a very particular perspective and a very particular set of arguments it's trying to make about why things happened the way they did. So, and I won't go too deep into the history arguments now. I'd be happy to at any time. But for people who don't know the game, John Company is it's two things. It's a business game and it's a negotiation game. So think about food chain magnate. But instead of everybody having their own fast food franchise, everybody is in one fast food franchise. And you might be the fry cook, and I might be the waitress, and someone else might be the shift manager, and someone else might be the owner. And
you just enraptured and terrified a certain percentage of our audience.
Right. And so when you think about that little pyramid, that little pyramid that you build in Food Chain Magnate, imagine each one of those slots is a seat. And you are fighting for control of the different seats. Because when I was, you know, when I was studying Empire seriously and professionally, the East India Company was always a confusing thing. I never really understood how it behaved. It was, you know, some imperial organizations are kind of comically evil in their actions, and others, like the British East India Company, were like inept in a way that didn't really make any sense. There was no, and what I started to realize as I learned more was there was no single mind. It was a lot of people at cross purposes. And so what might happen in the game, in the game you play British patriarchs and matriarchs who are managing little families, and you are trying desperately to use the East India Company to elevate the respectability of your family. So you do this through negotiations and by using the company. So you might, for instance, promise someone in marriage if they will consider hiring your nephew for a position in a logistics office. And then when that nephew when that nephew has an illustrious career and eventually retires from the company, you might have to borrow money from a third player to buy a giant estate. And then in a couple generations, if you're having trouble keeping the upkeep on that estate, you might have to sell like a seat in parliament to just make the expenses. So, it feels like a big Victorian novel.
Interesting.
But it puts things in their proper context. And this is, you see games like Obsession, which I think is a fine game, or even like Jane Austen games. And what I always wish those games had was a more organic and open context to offer their players about why all these British people were getting so rich. And this game very clearly trains its argument on India and on the empire.
It's interesting because you're approaching these games from a academic and your own personal, study of, years and years, your PhD, correct me if I'm wrong, your PhD is in academics around history, right? Specifically, can you help me specify what it's in?
So I studied in the English department at the University of Texas at Austin. Some of my committee had affiliations with the history department. So I was I always felt like I was straddling in between history and English. But I worked on 19th century British Empire and particularly how people use novels to understand the imperial experience. Like these were all citizens of, all of them were citizens, but these were people experiencing the British Empire firsthand and then trying to make art that couldn't help but be imperial in its nature.
It's interesting to me because I see your games as historical documents. I mean, they're almost books or novels or literature around this history, whereas games like Obsession I see as Jane Austen novels, right? They're fiction, they're fantasy, they're love letters to a mythos, but they're not historically accurate necessarily, or at least not in the context or the foundation they have. They're more high fantasy or low fantasy, whereas yours are history, right? In a lot of ways.
When I was talking, I had the opportunity to speak at my alma mater recently, my undergrad, and someone asked me about how much work it takes to make a game. And it really is quite similar, at least for my method. Probably my method is not the best way of doing it. But for me, it really feels like writing a monograph or a small academic book. So
for sure.
the work of a game feels like mini articles. It feels like mini chapters of a book. They're just folded and presented in a different way. One of the nice things about Oath is that Oath is a hell of a word count if you were to put all the cards and teaching text and everything together. So
All that flavor text.
So I can tell people like, well, there's kind of a book in Oath. But that is certainly true for the history game. So
Absolutely.
When I was talking about Oath earlier, I was saying like, well, I have this idea of like how I want people to act, not act, but like the kinds of conversations that I see the game as being capable of creating. And John Company has a very similar kind of purpose because the negotiations in John Company, if you just adjust a few words, it sounds like you're listening to like an audio recording of Pride and Prejudice. They're just like right at that. And I think there are groups, but I also think it's more structured than many negotiation games, so that there are a lot of players, and this is true of the first edition too, but it's been true of our testers for the second edition, who say, look, I never play negotiation games. I think they're stupid. But I kind of like love John Company, and I really like the kinds of negotiations it offers. So I think that, even if you've never tried a negotiation game before, I think John Company's got something to offer. The other thing I'll say about it as a negotiation game is that I have a design philosophy that tries to create systems that are strong enough so that you can remove all of the safety nets. Now that means that if you play very badly, there's nothing to catch you, right? But it also means that the games can do wilder things. John Company is an insane negotiation game in that regard, because basically everything in the game is negotiable. I have seen players like essentially offer insurance policies to each other and make really
it's kind of wild.
Yeah. I mean, it's like on one hand, it's extremely nerdy and kind of silly, but on the other hand, it's like, oh my gosh, are you like what you're saying is that if I fail to do this thing, I don't know if I'm going to do, I can send some money to you
and then I'll recoup
the costs. And it, so, I had a tester of the first edition of affectionately call the first edition of John Company, 18XX, the role-playing game, which I love that line. And I, you know, maybe I'll even stick it on the box or something. So it, you know, it's a very big economic game. It has a bunch of scenarios in it. And I'll say that, you know, I'll give kind of like, it plays 1 to 6 players. Richard Wilkins will probably be designing, Ricky Royal, the same person who designed the Wakan bot for Pamir, will probably be doing a solo mode for the game. But one of the things I love about the system is that the introductory scenarios are about running the company in the 18th century. But one of the things that happened to the British East India Company is it was a trade monopoly, but it lost its monopoly. It got deregulated. And so that can happen in the game too. And so, you know, for the first half of the game, you could be, you know, working within the company, playing the bureaucratic game, trying to get votes in the different places where you need votes. And then if the company stumbles a little bit, the parliament can yank its trade monopoly. And now players can form little startup trading firms and try to compete with the big company. And that's when the game really goes off the rails, because suddenly people are like, if you give me your votes on this law, I'll give you a 30% interest in this person's private firm. And it really gets wild.
Sounds awesome. So I do have a bit of a problem, though.
Sure.
Because I could genuinely listen to you talk about game design and the projects you're working on and the history and intricacies of all of this for the next 10 hours straight. I know I don't have too much time left with you, and I do have a few more Patreon questions that I want to hit. So the audience members who are sitting here going, oh, by golly,
more about John Company.
That I didn't let you.
Don't worry.
Yeah, that I didn't let you keep talking. Here's what I'll say. Just continue pestering us, and as we approach March and that next launch, hopefully we'll be able to get another conversation up and running.
Oh, and I'll get you, I'll get you said, and your crew into a play test. We can play John Company right now.
Oh, that'd be so cool. That'd be so cool. All that being said, I do want to make sure I hit on some of these. Let's go quickly through them, and then, sir, I will release you to go continue creating beautiful things and making the world a better place.
Well, thank
which
you.
Sounds sarcastic when I say it, but I genuinely. Mm-hmm. Genuinely mean that. Let's see here. So Kenny, this is going to be one of the designers mm-hmm. in our Discord, who's actually working quite a bit, playtesting his game quite a bit with the community at the moment. He said, can you clarify a little bit more about designing a good game, not a fun game? There was an article interviewing mm-hmm. you recently that was certainly a bit polarizing.
Yeah.
Can you clarify what that, and I don't have context
sure,
for this
sure.
question.
So this was, so a, this is was all a, you. A dice breaker piece where I talked about how fun is not something that we should be like aiming for as designers, because it's an empty signifier. It doesn't mean anything. It could, well, or rather it means a lot of different things to different people. So when I'm working on a design, sure. I'm never really interested in just fun. What I tend to think about is that games are capable of producing all kinds of emotions, and you know, glee, or like, you know, the fact that someone's going to laugh at something or cheer at something, what we might recognize as fun if we were like viewing a camera footage of a game being played. I think that kind of joy, that's a really important emotion, but the really good games are going to make you nervous. They're going to make you anxious. They're going to make you fearful. They're going to make you excited. They're going to make, you know, you laugh. And so,
and that's the signifier of good versus fun. Fun being an emotion that a game could elicit, whereas good being the qualifier for, like, for instance, ISS Vanguard has probably one of my most heartbreaking and despondent moments I've experienced in a game. That moment was not fun. You can see me physically shut down and change, but it stuck with
me.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, good is going to mean different things to different people, but I will say when it comes to me personally, a good game for me has a very broad emotional range. And so when I'm designing, that's kind of one of the things I'm looking for.
Interesting. From Raphael, what theme would you like to design a board game around?
So I have two historical games I'm noodling on right now that I desperately want to spend my energy on, but I can't because I have lots of things ahead of them in the queue. One of them is a game about Reconstruction, you know, for the 12 years or so after the Civil War, which I've thought a lot about, and I have an engine, I have historians I've talked to, and that I'm going to be talking to more in the future. I cannot wait to make this game. It feels timely and urgent, and I am excited by it. The other project I really want to work on, but I haven't gotten started in earnest, is in economic games, we have notions of game systems, right? Power Grid or Age of Steam, which have different maps. That doesn't really exist for sure in political games. And what I would love, what I would love to do is design a game about civic politics, community organizing, that kind of stuff, that was a system so that you could adapt it to a lot of different historical contexts. And then I could invite designers from marginalized communities to work on games about things that I may not have ever heard of that affected their community. And so right now I'm starting to do research on the building of 94, a big highway in Minneapolis that kind of tore apart a neighborhood. And I'm thinking about this as the subject for maybe the first module of this game. And I'm just kind of like lightly thinking through this. And I've been thinking a lot about municipal politics.
Sounds so cool. I also love that idea of building a structure and a system that gives permission to other people to explore and add their own sort of narrative to and tweak as they develop. I love that groundwork. It's almost mentorship in a way.
Well, one thing that I'm real very conscious of, and that Drew and I really try to do, is think about ourselves as like we're members of a community, and we've been very fortunate to be lifted up by that community, and we want to make sure we can lift up other people too. And so, along these lines, everything I do with WhirlyGig, I put into the Creative Commons under a non-commercial license. So if anybody wants like those files or wants to build a kit or wants to learn how to make a PAX game, like you can just have that stuff as long as you don't try to sell it. And that will be true of John Company. It will be true for everything we do will go into the Creative Commons under a non-commercial license.
It's interesting because it's sort of our approach, but not from a publisher game design approach. It's from a media approach. How do we, instead of absorbing and capitalizing on voices, help bring the community up in a way that gives people their own platform and their own voice in collaboration and collection in a community way? I love that. I love that style. I love that thought process behind it. I think it takes longer to execute on. But I think once we get somewhere where we have, our community is expanding so quickly right now, and it's one of the most exciting things about what's happening in this space. All right, I'll continue poking some questions.
Yeah, fire away.
What kind of changes do you expect when you're looking at a second edition of An Infamous Traffic, which is another one of your historical games? Ooh. And are you currently looking at a second edition?
I am. That will be the thing that we do right after John Company. We've already started working on it a little bit. Infamous Traffic is a game that I like quite a bit, but it was made very quickly. Usually when I make games, they take a long, long time. Infamous Traffic, I designed in the hospital before and after my second son was born. Just doodling on paper and on my laptop, because while my wife is sleeping, of course, I'm not a monster. then I worked on it over that summer, and it was finished by the end of the summer. I've never made a game that fast. And I think it's good, but it has a couple of funny quirks. One of them is it is a better game if the players play it a little bit looser, which is a kind way of saying it's a better, like the later part of the game is better if players played worse at the beginning. This is a very funny and strange design problem that I want to fix, and I don't know how I'm going to fix it, but that's like the area that I'm looking in. What ends up happening is that if players play too conservatively in the early, like there are some optimal strategies around playing very conservatively in the early game, which make the rest of the game a little less interesting. If players play a little goofier and a little riskier in the early game, the second half of the game is awesome. So I'm going to be tackling that subject. I don't know how I'm going to do it yet, though. In terms of production... Yeah. Infamous Traffic will probably be cheaper than the other games like John Company. So we have like, I don't know how much John Company is going to cost. It could cost as much as Premiere or even a little bit more. It's going to be awesome. Infamous Traffic might be a little bit cheaper than Premiere. I really want to use like a kind of Bakelite tiles instead of the counters. So like think about Azul or something.
For sure.
And there's some really cool production stuff we want to do with it.
That is, though, you know, you're stating that before a year and a half of development happens and you decide to completely rework, rebuild and restructure the entire core system of the game, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'm just picking on you there. So a few more here. I think you already answered this one at the beginning, but I'll just get a quick answer here from SC. Mm-hmm. What was the first game that inspired you to become a board game creator?
Well, there were lots. One that I mentioned recently, which I'll mention again here, is I love Pierre Sylvester's King of Siam. I think it is amazing. Okay. And then the other one would be probably Pax Perfuriana.
Okay. Terror on ISIL. What animal do you wish you could have included in Route that just wouldn't fit yet in the forest theme specifically?
Ooh, oh, what a good question.
A starfish, maybe?
A starfish.
he said that he'd love to see a sloth.
Yeah, so like sloths, I was going to say sloth. Sloth is great because it's just not like, so we have these funny qualifications where like ideally it should be like a British woodland because we have that kind of storybook sure. aesthetic. So they're like, or one that comes to mind is like mongooses, which I love. Just doesn't fit because they're just not going to be in that era. What are some other ones? We have a ton. We recently struggled with the fact that turtles just like don't graft well to what we.
I saw the turtle spite. Like there was a promise of turtles potentially, and then they got replaced or recycled.
Yeah, it was just one of those things that like there are turtles in Root. Here's, people who get the Root RPG will see some turtle art, but for what we needed it to do, it just like wasn't right.
Yeah. Well, here's the issue. Turtles don't need to struggle for power. They dominate any space they exist in. They're just that powerful. It really would have been unbalanced if you'd included them in the narrative.
Turtles OP, just conceptually.
From Jokari, will leader games likely stick with fantasy / fictional things with their games, or is there any potential for historical titles like you do in Whirligig to bridge over into the leader games franchise?
We will not be doing historical games at leader games. There are some games about contemporary issues that might be interesting, but there's a hard line that we are definitely not going to be doing historical games.
From that guy, has the theme of any of your games ever led to reworking or rethinking the mechanics? I think this is a pretty easy answer.
Yes, constantly.
I was going to say, the amount of weight and history and even you talking about how you want people to discuss things like Oath and the narrative you want to see spilling out, that has led to constant reworking.
Whenever we encounter a design problem, one of the first questions we ask when we're having meetings is like, what are we really trying to model here? And then how do other adjacent things look like that in the system? And then that's our guiding star.
From AG, what are you most excited about working on for the upcoming development schedule for Leader? What is on your radar that you might be able to just give a hint of?
Sure. So I'm almost done with my Root stuff. So all the Root design liability that I have for this expansion will be done within the next week or two. And at that moment, my Root time is mostly project management and working on the Kickstarter and helping everybody, get along and get it done. And my design time at Leader shifts to a space project I'm working on, which
very
is
cool.
Very fun and exciting. And I cannot wait to tell people about
it. Cute little animal factions, right?
There are no cute animals. But it's going to be amazing. I can't this space game I built in the fall with Patrick. We were working together on it, and I built this engine for it that is totally unlike anything I've built before. And it is a scream. I think people who play Oath and think, oh, I thought this was going to be the follow up to your hit game Root. I'm like, no. Oath is its own weird thing.
Yeah.
But if people want the follow up of something of Root character, just in terms of the size of the box and the scope of the game, the space game we're building is very much like a follow-up.
I love
and
that.
It's going to be awesome.
I love that. And I have another hard-hitting question here for you. What is your favorite flavor of ice cream?
Wait, favorite of flavor of ice cream?
Yeah, it's an important
it's so
one.
So important.
The people want to know.
Can I pick two or do I have to pick one?
I believe you can pick two, but they have to be ranked. And I do have to say there is at least a few of your core fan base that are weighing their future support based off this question alone.
This is a hard.
Yeah. So this was probably the most stringent one. I saved it for the end for a reason.
If you live in Austin, Texas, and you can go to Lick, which is an ice cream place in Austin, Texas, they have a mint chocolate chip that is transcendent. It's incredible. There's nothing like it. Outside of that, my go-to is Rocky Road. If I'm at the store, I'll grab Rocky Road. I love it. The kids love it. I'm going to be the hero of the day if I buy it. But if I'm in Austin, if I can get the good mint chocolate, that's where I'm at. That's where my heart is.
Nice. Very nice. And the last question point here, and I kind of want to see how you answer this. I can rephrase it if we need, but from Jokari and then from Timothy Snyder, Jokari asked, why are you the best designer? And Timothy Snyder rephrased it to, how are you the best designer? And so I'm going to restructure this just slightly. Through your few years in this space, through exploring and learning and developing as a board game designer that now has a lot of attention, a lot of eyes, has one project that has skyrocketed to the, you know, stratosphere and a bunch that are following in its footsteps. What have you learned through this process over the last few years? What are you still personally working on? What is currently on your radar when it comes to improving yourself in terms of becoming what some people ascribe you as, right? The best designer.
Well, I try to get better. Everybody, at least this is a pet theory, but anyone who creates anything, they have voices in their mind that are voices of people they know that they've internalized, and even their own voice, that all have different tastes and that cheer, you know, that might cheer for certain kinds of things. When I think about myself as a designer, at a really fundamental level, I'm trying to make the kind of games that I would have wanted to exist when I was like in high school and college. The kind of games that when I get with my brother and my close friends, we're going to play those games and really have a great time. That if we were to go out to a cabin and spend a few days, we would bring a copy of Oath and play the hell out of it. And so that's like my guiding star. I don't want to make any game that I wouldn't want to play and to think about seriously and to really like dig into. And I think that over the last several years, I've gotten a lot better at understanding the sorts of games that are like that for me. And so when I first got hired by Patrick, I remember telling him that I thought I wasn't a very good content designer. I thought I was very good at systems. I think about systems and I don't really think about content. And Patrick agreed, and we would often design and develop around that problem, like knowing that I'm going to be better at a system than, you know, I don't want to design a deck of cards. And then when I was working on TMM, and I was lead developer on TMM with Nick Brockman was helping me, and I just got better at doing card design and doing content design and special power design, and I started taking it very seriously. And then that work prepared me for the Exiles and Partisans deck and for Oath and for the special cards in Pamir and for like the prizes and prestige cards and laws and John Company. And that has been a part of my practice that I've been trying to shore up. I feel like as a designer, I'm trying to, always do two things, right? I'm always trying to make games that I can be proud of and that I earnestly want to play. I'm not the kind of designer who, when I'm done with a project, never wants to look at it again. I want to make something that I think I would like to look at again. And I also try as a designer to really readily assess where I fail and try to improve those things. At least once a week, I go to BGG and I read all the new comments for all the games I've worked on, including
that sounds like a very dangerous piece of advice.
No, correct. Including the really negative stuff, because that's where the hard truths get told. And I think it's really, I mean, believe me, it's not always good for my mood in the morning. If I just read a bunch of people who'd hated something, I've ruined somebody's birthday once. I ruined someone's birthday once because they played a game of mine they hated so much and everybody had a bad time. But I want to understand the places where I could have done better, right? And so
for sure,
to the degree to which I'm a good or bad designer is, at least personally, is just, am I measuring up to those two things?
Very cool. So thank you so much for the time. Thank you for the conversation. I certainly hope we get a chance to do a few more of these, because I'm always intrigued and fascinated by your approach to game theory and design and community, and really you're thoughtful about the way that you approach this hobby and your life in a way that I personally find fascinating. So I appreciate you. I'm super excited about the projects that you're working on, and I can't wait to see what's next.
Thank you very much for having me, Jesse, and hopefully we'll play John Company soon.
Yeah, I'm so. I mean, do you got like a couple hours after? No. Okay. Well, we'll figure it out. We'll get that time slated. All that being said, if you made it to this part of the podcast, well, this is the end. Hopefully, you enjoyed it. And if you do like this concept, this brand new approach to doing some interviews here as part of the network on the podcast over the next few years, let us know. Let us know who you'd like us to talk to, what you might be interested in from any realms or sectors in the board game industry or space. I know Jan, me, and Alex from Board Game Co. Are all interested in approaching conversations and finding out and discovering more about what exists in our hobby, who's doing what people are working on, and how we can continue building and lifting up voices in this space. So all that being said, thank you so much. And there's not an ending to this. So Jan, cut it here, I guess.
All right. Sounds good, Jan.
This latest failed attempt at bringing you quality entertainment was brought to you by the Quackalope Podcast. We love to hear from you, so don't forget to leave a review and subscribe. If you'd like to connect with us, follow us on any of our social channels or visit our website. But regardless of what you do, remember to do the important thing: get out and play some games. Until next time.